This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Thursday, October 3rd. I'm John Wanamaker. Complaints about MinSure are continuing as consumers ran into difficulty creating accounts on the state's new online health insurance marketplace for a second day. Frustration is spreading to the health insurance industry and social service providers, where officials are raising concerns that prolonged problems may reduce overall enrollment. Elizabeth Stewicki reports.
Tony Yanni says he met the perfect candidate for MinSure plans, a woman in her mid-50s whose income is a little too high to qualify for free or low-cost government coverage. She wanted to enroll in a commercial plan. As a financial counselor at Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis, Yanni helps patients find health insurance. Yanni said the woman tried to log on to MinSure several times at home Tuesday, but was unsuccessful. So after her medical appointment yesterday, she asked Yanni to help her. Together, they ran into the same problem. The site would only let her get so far, and then she'd hit a roadblock.
We went through the whole system. We went through the website, and she's like, yep, this is exactly what I was experiencing yesterday as far as glitches go. So what I've asked her to do is just kind of stick with me until we find a plan for her. So what she's going to do is call me back next week. We're going to try it again to price out a plan.
Yanni and the patients he helps are not alone. On news and social media sites, consumers have been venting about going on the MinSure site, only to get so far and then nothing. That was a common complaint Tuesday afternoon when MinSure went live. MinSure officials said then a faulty server was to blame and was fixed. Now, Executive Director April Todd Momloff says the main problem is out of MinSure's hands because it's a federal security requirement.
If you go through the process three times and it doesn't work, you have to wait a week to be able to go back in.
That was a policy that may not have been widely understood, even though Todd Momloff says it's mentioned on the MinSure site. She says heavy traffic overloading a key federal data hub is another problem, because state exchanges must use that system to verify an applicant's income status and citizenship. Scott Kiefer with Blue Cross Blue Shield Minnesota calls the overall experience of MinSure and the other state insurance marketplaces clunky.
And I think with that clunky experience comes concerns as to whether enrollment is going to go as smoothly and as people are going to get in as much as we would like to see, because we want to see every Minnesotan that's eligible for premium tax credit assistance to get into the reform market.
Todd Momloff acknowledges that the system hasn't worked ideally, but says the problems are just temporary startup hitches, and people have until the end of March to enroll.
You know, I would say this is a relatively small issue. I mean, I know we have people that do want to get in right away, but they have a few months to come in and get their account set up and get their coverage through.
Danette Coleman at Minnetonka-based Medica hopes consumers will be patient and understand that a project of this size will take time and won't work flawlessly out of the gate. But she also worries that people may not respond that way.
What we don't want to have happen is we don't want to have people go to MinSure, find that it's not working as they expected it to work, and then not come back.
And that concern is not limited to people selling insurance. Hennepin County Medical Center financial counselor Tony Yanni echoed those concerns for his clients.
And I just don't want people to get discouraged and give up and say, oh, I'll check it next month, and then end up forgetting about it.
MinSure said consumers have created more than 2,500 accounts, but wouldn't say how many of those users actually enrolled in a health plan.
That's healthcare reporter Elizabeth Stewicki, and there's not much progress to report as the federal government shutdown enters a third day. One possible area where Democrats and Republicans could find some common ground is a tax on medical devices that helps pay for the Affordable Care Act. As our Washington reporter Brett Neely explains, no one seems to like it much, and repealing it could be a boon for a hometown business.
To pay for the 2010 health care law, Democrats negotiated new taxes and fees with insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, and the medical device industry. Device makers, including Minnesota companies such as Medtronic and St. Jude Medical, are paying a 2.3% tax on the sales of devices such as pacemakers and stents that will go towards subsidizing the cost of health insurance for the uninsured. The idea was that those firms would make more money with all of the newly insured patients who needed things like hip replacements or insulin pumps. But the industry never really liked that bargain and has fought hard against the tax, spending more than $100 million on lobbying since 2010. On Tuesday, just a few hours after the shutdown began, Dick Durbin, the second-ranking Senate Democrat, made it clear in an interview with CNN that the device tax was on the table.
We can work out something, I believe, on the medical device tax. That was one of the proposals from the Republicans.
The industry's argument has been that the tax will lead to layoffs at home with the jobs going offshore. There's not much that the 10-member Minnesota congressional delegation agrees on, but they seem to agree that the tax is a bad idea. Along with DFL Senator Amy Klobuchar, 3rd District Republican Eric Paulson has pushed Congress to repeal the device tax. Paulson says he's talking to Democrats now to find the $3 billion a year that's needed to offset the cost of getting rid of the tax as part of a way to end the shutdown.
And the challenge for us and the solution for us is to find the middle ground to end the impasse. And the medical device tax, I think, is the one vote that had the most bipartisan support as an example.
The logical link between ending a budget shutdown and repealing a tax that affects a prosperous industry isn't clear to Paul Vandewater, a senior fellow at the Liberal Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. Instead, he says it's part of a Republican strategy based on hostage taking, in this case, the operation of the federal government.
And it doesn't seem to make any difference whether or not the item is truly related to the budget or not.
As for the tax and its ill effects on the device industry,
there's no evidence at all that any of these dire predictions have come to pass.
The Obama administration also takes that line and has threatened to veto past repeal attempts. But plenty of liberal Democrats across the country represent states and districts where the industry has a big presence, and they're open to undoing the tax, leaving Obama without much political cover. Even 5th District Congressman Keith Ellison, one of the most liberal Democrats in Congress, says he supports repealing the tax.
I'll put it like this. We're not going to delay, defund, and destroy Obamacare. That's out. It will not happen. But we're open to a discussion about other ways to move forward.
Ellison says one reason the tax is on the table is that Republicans are beginning to realize that the government shutdown is hurting their party.
What the Republicans are doing, shutting down government, is ugly and bad, but they need some sort of a face-saving move to get out of it.
First District Democrat Tim Walz says Republicans need to show conservatives that they at least got a chunk of Obamacare undone, even if the central part of the law remains intact.
And I think maybe there's some folks saying, well, you know, if I can hang on to this, that gets me a compromise. Let me go back home and say I got it.
It's not clear if undoing the device tax alone will be enough to end the shutdown, but it seems like an idea that's gaining traction in Congress, right at the time those millions of new patients in need of medical devices are starting to sign up for insurance. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
An Iowa state senator has resigned after a special investigator found it likely he violated ethics rules by taking money from groups connected to Republican Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann when she ran for president. Kent Sorensen told the Associated Press his resignation was not an admission of wrongdoing. Mark Shelgren, also an Iowa Senate Republican, says Sorensen's decision was the right one.
I do not believe that the investigator's integrity is at question here. Only Senator Sorensen's integrity is at question. And I believe that there is enough evidence that says that Senator Sorensen's integrity has been compromised.
In his report, investigating attorney Mark Weinhardt said Sorensen was paid to be Bachmann's Iowa campaign chair, and those payments eventually reached $7,500 a month. They originated at Bachmann's political action committee in her presidential campaign and flowed through a Colorado consulting firm, which then paid Sorensen's firm. This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. A much-anticipated recommendation on the proposed Southwest Light Rail system has been postponed after a group of Twin Cities government leaders said it needed one more week to build consensus on the embattled project. The advisory board was poised to vote on a plan to run light rail trains underground in a shallow tunnel through the leafy Kenilworth Corridor in Minneapolis. The corridor is already home to freight trains and a popular bike trail. The delay comes as several Minneapolis City Council members are revolting against the tunnel. Laura Ewan has the story.
Just as the Corridor Management Committee was poised to vote on the tunnel, Peter Wagenius knew the votes were not in his favor. As he addressed his mostly suburban counterparts on the committee, the aide to Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback took stock of the morning's developments.
A very sad, very disappointing day.
Wagenius then launched into a tirade against years of planning for the massive Southwest project, planning that began with Hennepin County.
This project suffers from a failure to factor in freight. 17 years worth of failure to factor in freight.
He's referring to the major impasse that has stalled Southwest. What to do with the existing freight traffic in the Kenilworth corridor? Wagenius accused St. Louis Park of reneging on what he says was a promise to one day take the freight in exchange for receiving millions of dollars in cleanup money for a polluted site in the city. St. Louis Park, however, maintains it has fulfilled all of its obligations. Wagenius also blamed the project for caving into the wishes and whims of the railroads, which the Metropolitan Council says have veto power on rerouting the freight. But his recounting of perceived missteps in the planning provoked a challenge from Hennepin County Commissioner Peter McLaughlin.
Well, that's one version of history, I'd say.
McLaughlin acknowledged the assumption that freight trains would be diverted from Kenilworth to make room for light rail.
The fact of the matter is there were promises made 17 years ago, but the world's changed since then. The railroad industry is not the same as it was 17 years ago. And in the last 3 weeks, it's been demonstrated that the railroads aren't going to operate in good faith. And so we are in a box.
The Met Council last month agreed to commission a Colorado consulting firm to examine all possible alternatives for rerouting freight traffic from Kenilworth. But 2 weeks later, after visiting the Twin Cities, the consultants backed out, citing a conflict of interest with the railroads. The Met Council has no plans to resurrect that study. But the advisory committee today did agree to table the tunnel vote, at McLaughlin's suggestion, to give project officials more time to massage relationships with key partners. Those partners include state lawmakers who will be asked to pay 10% of the project. Southwest's price tag is now estimated at $1.55 billion, which would make it the largest transit project in Minnesota history. The project will also need to win the support of skeptical Minneapolis City Council members, many of whom slammed the project yesterday. They oppose any attempt to place light rail, freight rail, and the bike trail beside one another, which they say will happen when the LRT trains come above ground to cross a channel between two lakes. Edina Mayor James Hovland sits on the Southwest Advisory Board. He says he reluctantly supports the tunnel when balancing it against the alternative, rerouting the freight through St. Louis Park. That plan would require taking homes and businesses and elevating the trains on two-story tall berms past an elementary school.
If we believe in this regional asset and we believe in our metropolitan area, we need to be down on the Kenilworth and mitigate that as much as we can so that we don't disrupt the quality of people's lives.
But the question is whether key players with the project can persuade Minneapolis. Met Council Chairwoman Sue Haig offered no rosy predictions as to whether the project could secure the city's consent, which is required by state law.
I am not confident. I think this is their process. They need to spend their time looking at this issue.
It's also unclear what role, if any, Mayor R.T. Ryback will play. His aide Peter Wagenius says while Ryback is dismayed by the lack of options going forward, he remains a strong supporter of Southwest LRT. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Louis Park.
Five former and current students have sued Globe University and the Minnesota School of Business over misleading information. Alex Friedrich has details.
The suit says the school's inflated job placement rates and starting salaries for Globe graduates. It claims Globe also misled students about the accreditation of the programs and whether they could transfer Globe credits to other schools. Globe spokeswoman Naomi McDonald says the allegations are erroneous.
Although it's disappointing that even one student is unhappy with their education at Globe University and Minnesota School of Business, we know that the sentiment of these five students does not reflect the thousands of success stories we've had at our schools.
The student's attorney has asked the court to grant the case class action status. In August, a Washington County jury ordered Globe to pay a former dean $400,000 for firing her after she reported unethical practices there. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
For five decades, vibraphonist Gary Burton has been a pioneer, first on his instrument and later as an educator. From his work with sax great Stan Getz back in the 1960s to his experiments with jazz rock fusion, Burton has been a leading improvisational voice. In a new autobiography, Learning to Listen, Burton shares how he learned to listen to his inner musical ear and his true self. He performs tonight at the Dakota Jazz Club with the new Gary Burton Quartet. David Cassidy reports.
In the late 1950s, jazz artists embodied cool, and the music they created was on the cutting edge. Gary Burton, a young vibes player from Southern Indiana, couldn't wait to become part of that scene, and he didn't have to. He had his first recording contract at 17, and a few years later was playing with sax great Stan Getz. Even though the vibraphone was relatively new to jazz, Burton knew that the instrument he began playing at age 6 would take him places.
I learned the vibraphone at that young age, and it became so natural to me, so part of me, that even when I went through a period later of doubting that it was the best choice for me and I tried playing a few other instruments for a while, nothing felt as just naturally mine as my vibraphone playing.
Early in his career, Burton saw many of the downsides of the music business. The hardships of being on the road, drug and alcohol abuse, and life under an abusive band leader. At 24, he decided to lead his own bands. A Beatles fan, he was perfectly placed in history between jazz architects like Duke Ellington and Thelonious Monk and musicians from the rock era. Those modern voices include pianist Chick Corea, a contemporary with whom he has performed every year for 4 decades.
A lot of the founders of jazz were people that I saw in person and got to know in person and connected with. And that, to me, was the perfect bridge to my generation and the generations that followed who would not have the opportunity to connect to the original roots of jazz. I feel it was a really lucky timing for me, both as a musician and as a vibraphone player as well.
Burton's reputation grew, so did his ability to nurture much younger players. Teaching at the Berklee School of Music in Boston put him in touch with rising stars, among them guitar virtuoso Pat Metheny, another longtime collaborator. With students, Burton has long tried to share his knowledge of improvisation, how to communicate with the unconscious mind.
When I'm actually in the act of playing, it's almost as if I hear the music pretty much at the same time the listener hears it. As it's coming into my mind, my hands are going for the notes. So maybe it's a split second later that the audience hears those notes as well.
Now 70, Burton is showing a new generation how to unfold musical narratives using an instrument that has served him well. David Cáceres, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that's the NPR News Update for Thursday, October 3rd. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.